welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on Worldwide KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by the Lutheran Church Extension Fund, where your investments help support the work of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Friday, November 8th, we're studying Numbers chapter 31, verses 1 to 54. In today's text, the Lord commands His people to take His vengeance on Midian because of Midian's role in leading the people into idolatry. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, Pastor Jeremiah Johnson. Pastor Johnson serves at Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. Pastor Johnson, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So we get started today. Pastor, give us some context. What should we know about Numbers and what's been happening leading up to chapter 31?
You know, the Israelites are still trying to make their way into the promised land. And so they, here's a shocker. People aren't real happy about their presence, you know, being there when, you know, a couple of million people are probably camped out right on their doorstep. And so we see in the text today, well, we can get to it in a little bit, but we're going to see an episode that we're calling back from chapter 25, and the Lord's going to tie up some loose ends, you might say. So we're gonna have some more. We're gonna have a whole bunch of it stuff about spoils, and we're gonna talk about God's justice.
That's right. Tying up loose ends from chapter 25, I think, is a helpful reminder. At the end of chapter 25, the Lord had said to Moses, "Harass the Midianites and strike them down, for they have harassed you with their wiles." It was a matter of idolatry. And so He is going to give that command again, and it's going to be done here in this text. Just the fact that that was in chapter 25, and now we're in chapter 31, is probably an important detail as well, because now that we're in chapter 31, other than Moses, we're dealing with the new generation. Mm-hmm. And whereas the previous generation was faithless in the matter, especially that's going to be tied up today, in which Balaam, you know, led these Midianites to lead Israel into idolatry, that old generation had proved itself faithless. This new generation, at least at this point, that tends to be a lot more faithful. And that
right.
might be
so far, so good, right?
So far. Well, yeah. And I mean, we know how this is going to go. We know the rest of the Old Testament. But right. but so far, this new generation is showing itself to be faithful, which is one of the things that you see in the book of Numbers. There's a successful element to this new generation that the old generation did not have because of its faithlessness.
So, Pastor Apple, do you want to go ahead and you want me to rehearse a little bit from chapter 25? Because we
sure.
definitely need more details.
Yeah. Remind us what happened.
So the short of it is they, you know, well, Israel was camped close by. And there's a question, by the way, here, which I'm not going to do a lot of tackling. Like, what's the relationship exactly between the Midianites and the Moabites? I'm not going to tackle that because it's probably above my pay grade and I didn't have that much of a chance to look into it. But there is some sort of relationship. Midian may be this here, I just said I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do it anyway. Midian can be in reference to you know, either a people or what I think is more likely, kind of a general area. And in fact, it may be a little confusing to our listeners if they recall, because there are some Midianites that are, you know, that seem pretty good, right? I mean, in fact, Moses marries into a Midianite family. Remember, Jethro, you know, he's the priest of Midian, but that's in a more southern portion of the region of Midian. And what we'll see here pretty shortly is that that the people who the Israelites, you know, take vengeance on are the ones more of, you might say, northern Midian, probably not overlapping too much with the people that Moses is now related to. It's hard to tell exactly because these are large areas. And it's also worthwhile noting that that we often bring a sense of kind of the modern the modern state to to a lot of when we read the Old Testament. We really have to reprogram our thinking about this. You know, it's not like, you know, when we think France, for example, there's some very, very clear borders, and it's an entire nation. It's a lot of different cities, and there's a clear hierarchical relationship between them. Most of the ancient world, with the exception of like the empire of, you know, of Egypt, they're mostly, you know, city-states and loose confederations of these towns at most. And right. So for instance, Philistia, that you know, we're pretty familiar with, there are five different kings in Philistia because there's five different cities in Philistia. And sure. So likewise, when it talks about Midian, we can't think about this in terms of a modern country. This is probably just a bunch of larger cities all sort of banded together within a large geographic region. And sure. As we're going to get later on, five. But anyway, now well, I've gone off.
Just to briefly add to that, the reality ahead. that all of these people are related to each other anyways, if you go back far enough into the history,
right.
Such that with certain intermarriages, it's not hard to see one particular king perhaps at sometimes wanting to be known as a Moabite and another time maybe wanting to be known as a Midianite or whatever. You know, he wants to emphasize his connections on the mom's side this time or this time on the dad's side. So as you said, it's important to let these things be in their context rather than trying to read into our context where you look at a map, there are the nice clean borders. If you're on this side, you're in France. If you're on this side, you're in Germany. It's not quite that clean in this text. Very helpful realization. Keep reminding us what we're bringing back from chapter 25.
Right. So the problem that they ran into in chapter 25 is while they were you know, in Peor, or at least close to Peor, some of the Israelites, you know, took these, you know, these Moabite or Midianite wives, and just like the Lord had repeatedly warned them over and over again, you know, don't take foreign wives because they're going to lead you astray. Well, guess what happened? They led them astray, and they ended up worshiping Baal of Peor, which just means it's whatever kind of Canaanite god was associated with that particular town. Just a reminder that most, you know, the Canaanites understood their gods to be regional. It was a rather unusual thing for the Israelites to claim God to be God over the heavens and the earth. That was very abnormal. And so this was simply Baal, that means, which is the another word for Lord. So it was Lord of Peor, the Baal of Peor. And so they end up worshiping this false god. And of course, God's not happy about this because that directly violates the first commandment. And I think we do well to just pause on this a moment. I think perhaps, you know, we're going to see a whole lot of death. And I think, and I'm just going to anticipate one of the objections, which to be honest, I kind of feel a little bit myself. Like, well, why is there so much carnage, right? I mean, did God really have to command them to kill all these people? And I think perhaps, at least reflecting on my own response, I think part of our objection comes from the fact that maybe we don't take the first commandment as seriously as we should. You know, meaning that it is a more serious thing to worship a false god than it is to die. Like, in other words, it's better for you to die than for you to worship a god who is not the Lord. Maybe this is actually a good, I'm getting way ahead of myself now, but I'm just, you know, here's where we're going, folks.
Sure.
Maybe this should cause a little bit of self-reflection for ourselves. And I know it does for me, that how seriously do I take the first commandment? How seriously do I say, you know, we should fear, love, and trust in God above all things, even, and when we are scandalized by the fact that this, you know, this idolatry ends up being worthy of death, does that perhaps just mean that maybe we haven't taken the first commandment so seriously?
Yeah, the Old Testament has a knack of showing us in very physical ways the spiritual reality that idolatry is worse than death, even, and it leads to eternal death. And I think that's a helpful reminder at the outset of a text in which, as you said, we will see quite a bit of death simply to have that theological reality in our minds. We're seeing it played out in this text, and it serves as a stark warning in that regard. So with those thoughts in mind and the background in our heads, we pick up the text now in Numbers 31, beginning at the first verse. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Avenge the people of Israel on the Midianites. Afterward, you shall be gathered to your people. So Moses spoke to the people, saying, "Arm men from among you for the war, that they may go against Midian to execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian. You shall send 1,000 from each of the tribes of Israel to the war." So there were provided, out of the thousands of Israel, 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. And Moses sent them to war, 1,000 from each tribe, together with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, with the vessels of the sanctuary, and the trumpets for the alarm in his hand. They warred against Midian, as the Lord commanded Moses, and killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian with the rest of their slain, Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, the five kings of Midian. And they also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. And the people of Israel took captive the women of Midian and their little ones, and they took as plunder all their cattle, their flocks, and all their goods. All their cities and the places where they lived, and all their encampments they burned with fire, and took all the spoil and all the plunder, both of man and of beast. Then they brought the captives and the plunder and the spoil to Moses and to Eleazar the priest, and to the congregation of the people of Israel, at the camp on the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. Moses and Eleazar the priest and all the chiefs of the congregation went to meet them outside the camp. And Moses was angry with the officers of the army, the commanders of thousands and the commanders of hundreds, who had come from service in the war. Moses said to them, "Have you let all the women live? Behold, these, on Balaam's advice, caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against the Lord in the incident of Peor. And so the plague came among the congregation of the Lord. Now therefore kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known man by lying with him. But all the young girls who have not known man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. Encamp outside the camp 7 days. Whoever of you has killed any person, and whoever has touched any slain, purify yourselves and your captives on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. You shall purify every garment, every article of skin, all work of goat's hair, and every article of wood." Then Eleazar the priest said to the men in the army who had gone to battle, "This is the statute of the law that the Lord has commanded Moses. Only the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that can stand the fire, you shall pass through the fire, and it shall be clean. Nevertheless, it shall also be purified with the water for impurity. And whatever cannot stand the fire, you shall pass through the water. You must wash your clothes on the seventh day, and you shall be clean. And afterward, you may come into the camp." I'll pause there. That takes us through verse 24 of the text. All right, so Pastor Johnson, the Lord is the one that's giving these instructions to Moses. He calls for vengeance. He does give that brief note that, I don't know if you want to say anything about it, but Moses is getting close to the point right of his death. He's the only one from the last generation still alive, it seems, at this point.
Yeah, the only thing I would say about this is it seems important to the Lord, and perhaps you might even say gracious, that Moses gets to sort of see them through this next challenge for the Israelites and their temptation to idolatry.
Sure.
It's a little bit like, I don't know, I imagine like a father who gets to see his grandson born before he dies or something like
right.
that. This is one more significant thing sort of wrapped up for Moses. And I see it as, in many ways, a real act of mercy on the Lord's part to Moses.
Yeah, especially getting to see wrapped up an incident of great unfaithfulness now
right.
turn out in a very faithful way, almost an encouragement for Moses as he's about to die, and he's getting ready to deliver his farewell sermon in Deuteronomy to this very people. Here's something that he can call to their minds,
right.
and a very gracious thing for the Lord to allow Moses to be a part of this. So Moses is the one to, once more, give the instructions from the Lord to the people. He says, get ready to go to war against Midian. Maybe, and we just to get us back on that same conversation about what's going on here, it is the Lord's vengeance on Midian. I think
yeah.
that's important to see in verse 3. This is the Lord's vengeance.
Yeah, I think that's tremendously important. And this has a corollary in the way that we read the Psalms, for example, especially the imprecatory Psalms, that it is really critical that, it is the Lord is the one who is the judge. Ultimately, it is not for us, right? you know, to repay. Vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. And so, you know, what the Israelites recognize is this is not vigilante justice. They didn't decide like, oh, you know, well, these people were mean to me, so I'm going to go beat them up. This was actually a specific instruction from the Lord. And I think that makes a huge difference, you know, in as we read the scriptures, because there are other times where the Israelites, you know, go and try to, and do take vengeance on those people who the Lord has not said to, and they are reprimanded for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the Lord's vengeance that is being carried out. The Lord tells Moses, Moses instructs the people, and they are to gather an army for all of the counting that happens in the book of Numbers to number the army. There's not a ton of actual warfare. There is some. We saw it especially with Sihon and Og, the two kings that have already been defeated. This is one example where you see the army in action. And when you think back to the numbers that we heard most recently in chapter 26, 1,000 from each tribe certainly is not the full force of Israel that's available.
No.
Talk a little bit about the numbers in the book of Numbers here.
Yeah, I'm kind of shooting from the hip a little bit here, but it does seem very clear that this is not all the people he could have mustered. A lot of them stay home. And so I wonder if this is a little bit more of kind of a Gideon scenario. Remember, Gideon was the one who he gets too many people, and the Lord keeps sending all these people home until he's only left with 300. If this is perhaps one of those instances, because you notice it'll later say not one of them dies, not even one.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable. But I think one of the things that illustrates is the fact that this is the Lord's vengeance and it's the Lord's victory. In other words, you might almost ask, did he even need the Israelites? Sorry about that. That's my refrigerator. Did he really even need the Israelites to actually win the victory? And they do it with this rather small force, 12,000, and I'm guessing that, you know, for five cities, I mean, maybe that was a significant force, maybe it wasn't. But the fact that they didn't lose anybody really stands out to me. And the way that we'll later see as they divvy up the spoils, it's the Lord who also commands that as well. It's pretty clear who the real general is here. It's not the people, it's the Lord.
Yeah, and I think, although it isn't made explicit in this text, I think that small number is a part of what you're saying. Even in the last census in chapter 26, we noted that although it talks, you know, that this is numbered for the sake of those who can go to war, those 20 years old and upward, that chapter has a lot less emphasis on the war aspect and a lot more emphasis on the inheritance aspect. Mm-hmm. The Lord is bringing his people into the land to give it to them. This is his victory. He shows himself to be the general and the army, really, all wrapped up into one. That becomes even more apparent when you get into the book of Joshua, and even in Judges still, that same reality is at play. You see it here. So 12,000 from Israel, 1,000 from each tribe, go out to war, along with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and he takes with him both the vessels of the sanctuary and the trumpets for the alarm in his hand. Remind us of who Phinehas is and his significance in the army.
That's really important, because if you remember back in chapter 25, when the unfaithfulness of Israel was to be punished, Phinehas was one of the first guys to take up the sword.
Right.
And so in this way, I mean, he's almost commended, it seems like. I mean, the text doesn't quite say that, but it sure seems like of all the people to be picked, you know, handpicked, it's this guy who seems so zealous for the Lord to begin with. But it's also kind of unusual. They send out a priest, right?
Right.
But I think along with some of the implements of the tabernacle, and I almost wonder if this is also, you know, the ephod with the Urim and the Thummim, or I can never pronounce those right, but the implements where they would inquire of the Lord. And so I think the overall picture here is that, you know, they're not doing this sort of all on their own and under their own kind of auspices. They're doing so, you know, under the Lord's blessing with one of his priests, and it seems to be implied that their intention is to inquire of the Lord in this regard. And so once again, it's not just, you know, they're not going to do it by their own might. That's the what seems to be implicit with the small number of troops, but also with sending the priest, that this is the Lord's doing from start to finish, you might say.
Sure. And even maybe Phinehas, as opposed to Eleazar, his father. Mm-hmm. Eleazar, his father, is the one who's been installed as the high priest after Aaron. Perhaps Phinehas, with his example of faithfulness, is that this is about, like, what is it that will receive this victory that God's going to give? It's faithfulness to God and nothing else. Not any show of military might, not any particular tactics on the part of a very wise general like Joshua. And I'm not speaking to Joshua by any means.
Right?
No, I know. Joshua doesn't even get a mention. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So Phinehas is the example of faithfulness, it seems, at this point. And it's in that way serves as a fitting person to single out, mm-hmm. who's not of the, I mean, the 12 tribes that are mentioned doesn't include the Levites, at least mm-hmm. given what we've learned other places in Numbers. The Levites are not for the fighting. And yet Phinehas is a faithful one. He stands at the head in that sense.
Right.
All right, so we've got Phinehas with the vessels of the sanctuary, the trumpets for the alarm, and these go then to war against the Midianites. The actual description of what happens starts in verse 7. Take us into some of the details.
It's shockingly short, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this isn't your military history book here.
No, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, they all it says is they warred against Midian and they killed every male. And so now I think we need to understand this rightly within context, that this is every male that is specified by these five cities that they're, you know, they're killing, that are associated with these kings. And so this is probably not every male in Midian. I mean, this is one of those things where situations where you have to understand the implications and the context of this, because it's not long before you know, the book of Judges, that the Midianites, if you remember, before Gideon, are such a harassment to the Israelites. And so if they truly killed all the Midianites males, there would be no Midianites left. And so let the reader understand that this doesn't mean all of the Midians, but the ones that they were, you know, waging war against. But this is, you know, it's interesting. They, you know, Moses notes they killed every male, and they're later going to be chided for not also killing the females as well, because they need to purge the land of all of their of the people who led them astray. So, and then it lists off the five kings, probably the one for each town, like we mentioned before, not you know, ancient city states, not the idea of modern countries. And then there's even a call out for Balaam, right, who gave Israel, you kind of got to feel bad a little bit for this guy, just a little. Because, I mean, here, he's even the one who says to the Midianites, like, you know, he's the one, if you remember, who was sort of contracted by the Midianites to go and curse Israel. He says, well, I can't do it, right? And even his donkey won't let him. You kind of wonder, if did the donkey die too, or just Balaam? Hopefully just Balaam.
The donkey lived.
Yeah, I hope the donkey lived. That would make me happy. But he does finally get sort of his just desserts for being, I mean, this you know, this pagan prophet, ultimately. And even though the Lord uses him, but then ultimately casts him away. And so I don't know if there's much more to be made of it than just this carve out for Balaam. Did you have thoughts?
I think the mention of Balaam here helps us to understand more of what's going on in Numbers 22 to 24, where Balaam mm-hmm. is one of the central characters. Right. And as you said, he seems somewhat to be a sympathetic figure in those chapters. I think the way that the Lord brings Balaam to his end in this chapter helps you to realize you're not seeing everything there is to see of Balaam in chapters 22 to 24. He's not really a nice guy. Yeah. He, despite the fact that, yes, he maybe willingly or perhaps unwillingly says the things that he is given to say in those chapters, he was
just
still
trying
to bring Israel down.
Good, right?
Well, I mean, he's honest, I suppose, in the sense that he has to speak the Lord's word.
Right.
But here you find out that even in the midst of that, he's still trying to get Israel for whatever reason, whether it's his own, you know, his own desire to get them, or this is part of, you know, what he was hired to do, maybe. I think this is where you need to turn to fully get the picture of Balaam as you see part of it in chapters 22 to 24. That's the only thing that I think I would add. This shows you why Balaam elsewhere in the scriptures, especially in the New Testament, is not remembered with any fondness,
right,
and is constantly used as a negative example.
Well, perhaps while we're speculating, just a touch, there's one more possible explanation in addition to that, is that perhaps does the death of Balaam also sort of convict the Israelites a little bit? Like, listen, you guys, you worship Baal Peor, and now this is like the final sort of defeat of even his highest prophet.
Yeah.
Balaam, assumedly was associated with Baal Peor, and this is to further emphasize to them, like, this God has nothing left for you, right? There's nothing, he is powerless. It's a little bit like the plagues in Egypt, where the Israelites clearly see how the Egyptian gods are really nothing before the Lord. And perhaps there's something similar going on here.
I think that's right on, because when we talked about Balaam and Balak both in chapters 22 to 24, there's a number of places in that narrative where you see that they don't really realize what's going on, or at least they didn't know what they were getting into,
right,
when they decided to try to declare war against the Lord and against
but
his people.
But the donkey does.
The donkey does, which is part of the irony of it, that the Lord's going to do his work even when enemies stand against him. And so in that regard, I think you're right on with Balaam, that this is the final, the Lord showing he has won the victory for his people, even this false prophet who had attempted to deceive in a number of ways, he still was forced to bless the Lord's people, and now he receives justice at the Lord's hands as a part of this vengeance. So I think that's right on with the mention of Balaam. There's a lot more to talk about in this chapter. We'll pick it up on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Jeremiah Johnson about Numbers 31 this morning. We will be right back. Please stick around.
Lutheran Church Extension Fund exists to support Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries and church workers. How do we do this? Your investment with LCEF makes it possible for LCMS churches, schools, organizations, and church workers to receive low-cost loans for new and growing ministries. And faithful Lutherans like you, church members and church workers alike, make that possible when you invest with LCEF. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Friday, November 8th. We're studying Numbers chapter 31, verses 1 to 54 with Pastor Jeremiah Johnson. He serves at Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. Pastor Johnson, prior to the break, we had gone through the campaign against Midian as it's described very briefly in our text, talked a little bit about Balaam's role in all of this. It's probably a good place to pause in our conversation about the narrative itself and just reflect on something that you brought up already, the reality of God's justice and vengeance leading to all of this death. And many modern observers, particularly those who are not friends of the scriptures, look at a text like this and say, see how unjust or see how bloody your God is. How can Christians understand a text like this in light of the totality of knowing God is good and just and loving?
Right. This is a difficult task. And I want to encourage us not to run to explain away God too quickly. I mean, I think there are some explanations that would fit with our kind of our natural innate sense of justice, but I think much more importantly, we need to remember what our proper place is, and that is we are not the judge of God. Ultimately, if we really believe that He is, the Lord of heaven and earth, and ultimately he's the one who gets to determine what is truly right and wrong, what is good and evil. We need to be very, very careful that we don't start trying to judge God by our own sense of what justice actually is. So in other words, we don't get to evaluate God's morality. Let me take another example that's kind of classic for this, and that is Abraham and Isaac. Right? And I think we are way too quick to say, well, you know, God didn't really intend to, that Abraham would kill Isaac. But because, I mean, it's kind of a horrible thing, right? I mean, it's, God will later say, you shall not murder. But what does he command Abraham to do? He commands him to murder his son. Let's not nicify this. That's what it is. He commands him to murder, and sacrifice his own son. And there's plenty of other times where, you know, Israel is condemned for following the examples of, for example, Molech, who demands child sacrifices. And yet God himself does it. And we need to be able to say, God gets to do things that he can command us not to. And I think that's tremendously important because that reminds us of the place that we stand. Now, yes, we all know that in the end, Abraham provides God provides a substitute for Isaac. But is it really any less scandalous that when God brings his own son up to Mount Calvary, not Moriah, that he does actually let his son die? I don't agree with the conclusion, but I at least appreciate that there are some modern skeptics who say that the traditional understanding of the atonement, that is, God offering up his son as a sacrifice on the cross, is basically divine child abuse. I don't agree with that, but I at least want to empathize with the fact that I think they're seeing things from a truthful perspective. That this is indeed scandalous to us, and we can't just sort of wish it away. But here's the thing: is in the end, we sing in the hymn, right? What God ordains is always good. That's a very hard thing to believe, and yet that is what we are called to believe. It's what we're called to believe that, in other words, we don't get to audit God's morality. What he actually does and says is good by definition, by nature. And so we don't get to actually evaluate them. But now, having said that, so that's kind of, I think, the hardest pill to swallow. We should also keep in mind that one of the things the Lord reveals to us is, number one, his, what we might see as injustice, his greatest sense of injustice, that is letting his own son die for the sins of people who number one, don't deserve it, number two, don't even often appreciate it, that's ultimately for our good. And frankly, that's, I'm eternally grateful for that kind of injustice. Ultimately, you might even say that there is an injustice at the very center of our salvation. And it's ultimately the sort of injustice that saves us. I mean, do we want to call a flag on the play? Well, even if we wanted to, it doesn't matter because, we're not God.
So I think that's the place to keep coming back to.
Yeah, it has to be.
Because so and I might, I might push back on some of the specifics of ways that you said various things, but that's not the point of this conversation. What I think we really need to emphasize though is the reality that God is God and we are not. And
right.
And the full implication of that is this sort of scandalousness to us sometimes that we sometimes simply live with, that we simply trust him. Maybe the one way that I hold on to this in my mind is the question that Satan asks the Lord in the book of Job. Does Job trust God for no reason?
Right.
And that I think is if you understand that correctly, that's at the center of what we're talking about. Will we trust God
right.
for no reason other than that he's God and we're not? So that even when it looks like to our senses, God's not doing what we want him to do, he's God. And so what he ordains is in fact always good. What he does is right. And there is justice there.
Like, right.
That's where we have to come back to
right.
time and time again.
And you're so right to bring up the book of Job, because Job, you know, repeatedly asks for sort of his day in court against God. He wants to put God on the witness stand. And ultimately, the final answer to that is effectively, I mean, you know, he does it in a much more poetic way in what, chapters like 40 through 42 is, you know, sit down, I'm God, you're not. That's basically what the answer is. And in the end, it is though for, you know, what we see is we do see God's mercy, even though we don't see, you know, it's like sort of an explanation, what theologians usually call theodicy. You know, God doesn't have to explain himself, but in the end, he is merciful to Job. And I think that's the other dimension to this we have to remember. Now, I do have a couple of qualifications I do want to say to all this,
sure.
because I don't want to give anybody the impression that God is just capricious and that, like, well, whatever God feels like tomorrow, that's what he's going to do, and we can't really do anything about it. This is the beautiful dimension of God's faithfulness, his covenant faithfulness, his chesed. I think as we've probably talked about on this Bible study maybe a dozen times, sure. that, in other words, God does, you know, he doesn't go back on his promises, and he is faithful to those promises to us, so that it's not like we're always left guessing, even though ultimately, can he do whatever he wants? Absolutely. And yet he gives us the privilege of simply knowing the way he's going to act. He reveals that to us most poignantly in his son, Jesus Christ.
Sure.
And even with that, if I can add just maybe a few more ones that you might have, which might have been some of the directions that you wanted to go. There are also some kind of, you might say, more, there are things that are a little bit easier pills to swallow for us when we really look at the broader picture of, you know, the consequences of Israel's failure to purge the land of the Canaanites. You know, the Lord says, go kill them. He doesn't just do it because if God said to go and kill them, you know, yes, we need to be able to acquiesce to his divine authority. And yet at the same time, he actually says, listen, here's the rationale. You're going to be led astray by these people. That's why you need to purge the entire nation. That's why everything's got to go. That's why when Jericho falls down, you don't keep any of it, right? You know, all the people have to die, even the donkeys, because it's going to ensnare them. God actually has their well-being in mind when he makes these commands. And so I think we need to remember that as well.
Sure. And that's not an, I would say, a theodicy, but it's rather taking God at his word. And,
right.
and as you said, like whenever God tells you something, it's good. Another pastor asked at a presentation I was at recently, like, how many of God's commands did he give for our bad, like for our harm? Well, none. I mean, and that's something that is all a part of what we were saying earlier, letting God be God and us not being God, being those whom he has created and gives. So what you're doing is not explaining, but rather taking God at his word. As you said, this is really important. God's not capricious. Could he do whatever he wants? Yeah. But he's given his word to tell us what he's going to do. Here, we could even go back to our friend Balaam from earlier in the book of Numbers. God is not man that he should lie,
right.
or a son of man that he should change his mind. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not fulfill it? Balaam said that in Numbers 23, verse 19. So even Balaam in the midst of his attempting to hurt Israel, was forced to speak the truth. God tells us who he is. And so, yeah, he could do whatever he wants. Well, what does he want to do? He wants to save you. And so what he does is all with that good, ultimate good goal in mind. And all of that finally points us toward Christ on the cross, where these mysteries all come together, maybe not in a way that we can understand, but in a way that it is revealed. Maybe not the why, but who is God? That's who he is, right there on the cross for you.
Yeah, the who, not the why, is really what's critical for us. You said that very nicely.
Yeah, so those are all things to keep in mind as we grapple with texts like this as Christians, because as you pointed out, this is not only an objection that gets brought by skeptics, but sometimes these are things that Christians struggle with too. And so those are some ways to grapple with these realities from this text. Looking now more closely at what's here, you kind of talked about this a little bit already, and it's worth, they killed all the males. Moses isn't happy about that. Talk to us about why that's the case.
Right. It's pretty simple. It's not because he's not happy that they killed the males, but that they didn't kill the females because they were complicit in leading Israel astray. And now, what is interesting, though, you notice there is a distinction made between basically the young virgins and those who, right. you know, who had already slept with men. And so, you know, I think, you know, it's they are called, you know, their sin is described as whoring after these other gods. And I think there's a bit of literalism along with this about how the Israelites likewise were led astray by, let's just say, their own libido. So I think that's implicit there. But at the same time, it's not even a carte blanche, like, genocide. They spare those who were not apparently complicit in this sin.
That's right. Now talk more about, as you get to this matter, the spoils of the war, because not everyone is going to be killed in this, and not everything's going to be burned up. Some things are going to be kept. The matter of purity comes into play in a number of ways. Talk to us about the matter of purity in this text.
This is so striking that both the people, like the Israelites themselves who participated in this, and also the spoils of war are unclean. They all need purification. And so it's not, you know, so even the Israelites who obeyed the Lord, who said, you know, hey, you need to go to war against these people, even they still need to be cleansed. And I think there's a certain sense of this in which they've still been, even though this was a command by God, this was a really tragic necessity that still made them unclean. And so they still need to be purified, and even, you might even go so far as to say, forgiven by the Lord. In addition, all of the things which they received from the Midianites, they needed to be purified as well. They all needed to be made clean. And so, of course, then they go through the, ritual cleansings that they actually need to go through. It's interesting, I think, and maybe I'm reading a little too much into this, but you notice there's both fire and water. So some of the things get, cleansed by fire and some water. And if you remember the New Testament, what is the Holy Spirit associated with? Both fire and water. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there's maybe a little bit of a nod to the Holy Spirit and all that.
But that I don't know, Pastor
John. I don't know. It's a fun one, right? I mean, but don't go and preach that, anybody.
That's probably good advice. The fact that the purification comes up and even the water of purifying, I find just wonderful, because the water for purifying and the whole red heifer that was used for that in Numbers chapter 19 was a little strange of a chapter in the way that it was done. But here you see the Lord making good use of those regulations that he's already given to his people. And I think the matter of purifying after this war is important also as a reminder of whose war this is and how you actually stay connected to him. This is not the people of Israel earning their place before God. Their place before God is a gift. And so even as they've carried out his commands in doing this war against Midian, they still have gone near dead bodies and been around death. And the requirement for that is purification. You need to be made clean from death in order to stay near to the Lord's presence. And so he continues to provide for his people. This is all his gift to his people, not them earning something from him.
If I can make one more comment about that, I think one of the truths this also underscores is the fact that, even as they're getting prepared to enter into the promised land, they're still living in a polluted world. In other words, they can't help but be polluted by it, which underscores once again why they need the entire sacrificial system and the tabernacle and later on the temple. And I think it's probably a salutary thing for us to remember that, you know, living the church does not mean living in a place where we no longer need to be purified, but it's living in a place where we can be purified. But as long as we live here in this age, it is inevitable that we're going to come in contact with that which is unclean, and we're going to constantly need this repurification, you know, week after week, month after month, year after year, not until Christ comes again and restores all of creation. Is this need going to go away?
Let's go ahead and take a look at the rest of the chapter. We've read up through the matter of purifying the spoils of the war. Now we're going to hear more about the spoils themselves.
Yeah, so, a lot of it.
That's right. So we're picking up the text here in verse 25 of Numbers 31. The Lord said to Moses, "Take the count of the plunder that was taken, both of man and of beast, you and Eleazar the priest, and the heads of the fathers' houses of the congregation, and divide the plunder into two parts between the warriors who went out to battle and all the congregation, and levy for the Lord a tribute from the men of war who went out to battle, 1 out of 500, of the people and of the oxen and of the donkeys and of the flocks. Take it from their half and give it to Eleazar the priest as a contribution to the Lord. And from the people of Israel's half you shall take 1 drawn out of every 50, of the people, of the oxen, of the donkeys, and of the flocks, of all the cattle, and give them to the Levites who keep guard over the tabernacle of the Lord." And Moses and Eleazar the priest did as the Lord commanded Moses. Now the plunder remaining of the spoil that the army took was 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, and 32,000 persons in all, women who had not known man by lying with him. And the half, the portion of those who had gone out in the army, numbered 337,500 sheep, and the Lord's tribute of sheep was 675. The cattle were 36,000, of which the Lord's tribute was 72. The donkeys were 30,500, of which the Lord's tribute was 61. The persons were 16,000, of which the Lord's tribute was 32 persons. And Moses gave the tribute, which was the contribution for the Lord, to Eleazar the priest, as the Lord commanded Moses. From the people of Israel's half, which Moses separated from that of the men who had served in the army, now the congregation's half was 337,500 sheep, 36,000 cattle, and 30,500 donkeys, and 16,000 persons. From the people of Israel's half, Moses took 1 of every 50, both of persons and of beasts, and gave them to the Levites, who kept guard over the tabernacle of the Lord, as the Lord commanded Moses. Then the officers who were over the thousands of the army, the commanders of thousands and the commanders of hundreds, came near to Moses and said to Moses, "Your servants have counted the men of war who are under our command, and there is not a man missing from us. And we have brought the Lord's offering, what each man found, articles of gold, armlets and bracelets, signet rings, earrings and beads, to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord." And Moses and Eleazar the priest received from them the gold, all crafted articles, and all the gold of the contribution that they presented to the Lord from the commanders of thousands and the commanders of hundreds was 16,750 shekels. The men in the army had each taken plunder for himself. And Moses and Eleazar the priest received the gold from the commanders of thousands and of hundreds and brought it to the tent of meeting as a memorial for the people of Israel before the Lord. That is the rest of our text, taking us to the end of Numbers chapter 31. Pastor Johnson, we got about 6.5 minutes here to talk about these, the matter of spoils, some large numbers. As we were talking earlier about the small number of Israelites, the fact that there are 32,000 persons in all left over as those who were not killed indicates the great size of Midian, even at this point, and the great victory the Lord has taken. Where do you want to go with the matter of the spoils?
Right. Let's start at the end and note that I think it's just remarkable when you hear about the way that Israel was commanded. I mean, notice they didn't even, this wasn't even really their choice, the way that the Lord directed them to respond to the victory, and how much of a contrast that would be with, I think, so many other ancient people. You know, there's not a festival, right? There's not this great feast where they celebrate the, where they celebrate their own personal great victory. It's just that it's all carved up. And what do? They make atonement for themselves. They go to the Lord, they make atonement. And I think, once again, number one, all of this, both the fact that the Lord actually instructs them exactly and very precisely how to divvy it all up, still says to me, number one, the Lord's the general in all of this. He's the one. This is his victory. This is his army. This is not, it was not the greatness of the people of Israel who won this. But I don't know exactly what to make of the atonement, if this goes hand in hand along with the purification, but it just does strike me that there's almost a sense of kind of repentance and humility involved in all this, not this, braggartly kind of disposition where the people are like, "Hey, you look at how great we are. We conquered the Midianites," and they don't throw a parade. I don't know if they did parades back then, but anyway, I would think so. I know that they would throw feasts though.
Yeah,
you know, I've been listening to Herodotus's histories, and you know, and it's amazing. Like, you know, there's a giant festival after almost every great victory, right? And it's usually about, hey, look at how great we are, and this is such a contrast to all that.
Sure, sure. If I can, with the matter of the atonement and what the commanders themselves do, you wonder if it's in response to the reality that's spoken. It's almost easy to miss, but it's a key detail in verse 49. There's not a man missing from us. With all this battle and the odds stacked against you, numerically at least, the reality that none of the Israelites died is miraculous, to be sure. And I wonder if perhaps their response is in thanksgiving to that.
Right. And could you imagine, too, the generals, you know, and all the commanders, you know, kind of counting off, and, you know, one by one, all the companies saying, nope, nobody's missing, nobody's missing, nobody's missing, until they finally realize. I mean, that's got to be remarkable, because in the fog of war, you assume somebody's going to die.
Sure.
But they all get back and they realize, like, oh, nobody died, not even one of them.
And even more than that, when you go back to the previous context, the last time the people of Israel interacted with the Midianites, things went terribly for them.
Right.
They fell into idolatry, and lots of them died by plague.
Right.
Now, when they are faithful and listen to the Lord's commands, and seemingly odds are stacked against them numerically, what happens? Not a single one dies. I mean, what a contrast from chapter 25 in that regard.
That's right. It reminds me of what passage is that? It's early on, I think, either in Joshua or in Exodus. You know, the Lord will fight you for you. You need only to be still. Oh no, that's when they're coming out of Egypt.
Yeah,
right?
Exodus 14.
Yeah,
yep.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. And I feel like that's kind of once again echoing here in all that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and it was in Numbers 25, verse 9, those who died by the plague were 24,000.
Yeah.
This time, 12,000, half that number, went into battle. Not one of them died. The faithfulness of the Lord to his people is more than evident in that simple detail. Got about 2 minutes here, Pastor Johnson. All the spoils of the war are given. Even there, the Lord receives his due.
Right? Right.
Not everything is just enjoyed by the army, but the Lord receives his due. It goes to support the priests, the Levites. Lots of details of this chapter. Thinking about it as a whole, what do we make of this as Christians? What's the comfort, the good news, the instruction for us?
Right. I think the instruction for us, and it's a small thing, but I think it's significant nonetheless, is that I think what is also implicit, the fact that the Lord carves all this up, is that it all really belonged to the Lord, right? I mean, if his was the victory, who should be getting all of the, all of the spoils? The Lord should actually walk away with all the spoils, really. And yet he is gracious enough to them where he doesn't even give them 90%. He gives them, what is it? He gives them, I'm trying to do the math here. He's given them 98%.
He keeps
2%. 2%, that's it. One out of 50.
And even less from the other part, out of 500 there.
Right,
so.
Right. Yeah. And so I think it is really salutary for us to remember, just from our own perspective here, we didn't have to conquer the Midianites in order to get our daily bread.
Right.
Most of the time our employers are just writing our checks, but we do well to remember that this is, you know, all things, whether it is a victory in a battle or whether it is, putting our own talents to good use that are ultimately providing for our family, it all still belongs to the Lord. I mean, I know it sounds like the most cliche stewardship sermon, but still, nonetheless, it's true that we do well to remember that the Lord, you know, everything we have is simply on loan from him. And and rather than saying, like, listen, how much do I have to give back? Maybe we ought to be asking, look at how much the Lord lets me keep.
That's right. So yeah, it's all the Lord, he gives, and so he will make good on the promise to bring his people into the inheritance as the chapters of Numbers continue. Pastor Jeremiah Johnson serves at Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. He has been helping us today to study Numbers chapter 31, verses 1 to 54. Pastor Johnson, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about Numbers 31, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again next week. We will be wrapping up the book of Numbers over the last couple of episodes next week. On Monday, we will be in Numbers chapter 32. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again next week.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.